Hello, Sun Sounds listeners. This is Michael Shannon, your volunteer reader. I'm going to read the major news articles from the Monday, March 31st, 2025 edition of Tucson's Arizona Daily Star. Before we begin with the headline articles, let's find out what kind of weather is in store for us. Today's weather, partly cloudy, highs to 83 degrees Fahrenheit, winds west at 10 to 20 miles per hour. Tonight's forecast, some clouds, lows near 55 degrees Fahrenheit, west winds shifting to south at 10 to 15 miles per hour. Tomorrow's forecast predicts partly cloudy and windy, highs to 76 degrees Fahrenheit, winds west at 25 to 35 miles per hour. Winds could occasionally gust over 50 miles per hour. We'll begin with the reading of the first article on the Arizona Daily Star front page titled, Grijalva to Run for Late Father's Seat. This article was written by Charles Borla of the Arizona Daily Star. Adelida Grijalva will run for the Tucson congressional seat that belonged to her father. Memorial services for U.S. Representative Raul Grijalva were held last week. I am running for Congress because Southern Arizona deserves bold leadership that will fight for working families and stand up to Donald Trump. Adelida Grijalva said in a news release that was expected to be formally announced Monday morning. In Congress, I will work to create opportunities to help all our families achieve their American dream, no matter who you are, where you come from, or where you live. Grijalva is also expected on Monday to resign from her seat on the Pima County Board of Supervisors. It would be effective April 4th. Donald Trump, Elon Musk, and their gang of billionaires are destroying our nation. They're destroying our schools. They're attacking our most sacred rights. They're poisoning our environment, Grijalva said in the announcement obtained by the Star. But together we will stop them. This fight starts right here, right now, in Southern Arizona. A native Tucsonan, Grijalva was the first Latina elected to the Pima County Board of Supervisors in 2020 and is the second woman to have served as the board's chair. She easily won a second term last November with 73% of the vote. Prior to her 2020 election, Grijalva served for two decades on the governing board of the Tucson Unified School District, first having been elected in 2002. She also served as a director of Pima County's Teen Court, a nonprofit diversion program, for over 25 years. Adelida Grijalva, a Democrat like her father, had previously said she would announce her decision after her father's funeral services, which took place last week. Raul Grijalva had been fighting lung cancer for about a year, and his death at age 77 was due to complications from cancer treatments, his office said. Grijalva seeks to follow her father's own political ascent to the Capitol. Like her, his political career started at TUSD, continued into the Board of Supervisors, and ended in Congress after he beat several political opponents to win a newly created district. Grijalva's impending resignations from the supervisors will set in motion an appointment process to replace her, as occurred when longtime supervisor Sharon Bronson resigned in late 2023. The heavily Democratic congressional district is anchored by a chunk of Tucson, but spans much of southern Arizona, Yuma, and parts of central Arizona. Of the nearly 260,000 registered voters in the congressional district, more than 110,000 are Democrats and about 54,000 are Republicans, and nearly 91,000 are independent, the Pima County Recorder's Office said last month. Tucson Mayor Regina Romero, who says Grijalva has the backbone to stand up against the Trump agenda, will be the campaign's chair. Romero ended speculation that she'd seek the post soon after Grijalva died. Adelida Grijalva is a results-driven leader who fights for good jobs, our children, and our environment. She believes that strong public schools and strong unions are important for hardworking families trying to make ends meet, Romero said in the news release. She is the leader to meet this moment, and which is why I wholeheartedly endorse her campaign to keep a progressive champion in Congress to represent Southern Arizona. As of Sunday afternoon, 27 candidates filed statements of interest to run in the special election for Congressional District 7, according to the Arizona Secretary of State's office. That includes 13 Democrats, including former state lawmaker Daniel Hernandez, 10 Republicans, including Daniel Gutierrez, who lost to Raul Grijalva in the November 2024 election, 2 Libertarians, one Green Party candidate and one No Labels Party candidate, according to the office. The primary election will be on July 15th. The general election will be September 23rd. Candidates have until April 14th to file to run for the congressional seat and begin collecting nominating signatures. Independent candidates who only run in the general election must file by April 14th. The registration deadline to vote in the primary is June 16th. Early voting begins June 18th. The deadline to register for the general election is August 25th. The next headline article is titled, Watsek Sues Over Traffic Stop. This article was written by Howard Fisher of Capital Media Services, Dateline Phoenix. Defeated State Senator Justine Watsek is making a federal case out of being stopped for criminal speeding last year by Tucson police, accusing multiple officers and unnamed city officials for violating her civil rights by stopping her in the first place and then later giving her a citation. It was all part of a conspiracy to silence her politically, Watsek claims in the lawsuit filed in federal court. It also alleges the whole incident with Watsek being stopped near the University of Arizona campus in March 2024 was designed to target her for prosecution on trumped-up and phony charges, chill Mrs. Watsek's political free speech, and knowingly and wrongfully interfere with her right to hold public office and pursue her chosen occupations. The negative publicity surrounding all of this amounted to a $9 million gift in free media for Vince Leach, says Dennis Walinchek, her attorney. After Watsek was stopped and later cited, Leach defeated Watsek in the Republican primary last August in LD 17, which covers portions of eastern and northern Pima County and spills into Pinal County. Leach then went on to win the general election. In her lawsuit, Watsek claims she's able to show more than $8 million in damages directly caused by the city and its officers, not inclusive of emotional distress, psychic trauma, and other general damages incurred. A police spokesman said Sunday the agency could not comment on litigation. There was no immediate response from the city attorney's office. All this stems from an incident a year ago when she was pulled over on East Speedway by Officer Ryder Schrag, who said he caught her on radar doing 71 miles an hour in a 35 miles per hour zone. Watsek said she was racing to get home because the battery in her all-electric Tesla was about to run out of charge. "I was not doing 70," she's heard telling the officer who recorded the interaction in his body camera. "Yes, you were," he responded. "I was behind you. I had my radar on." Watsek also identified herself as a state lawmaker. A few minutes later, the audio on the office body camera goes mute, presumably when he was checking with superiors. She was not ticketed immediately based on a provision in the Arizona Constitution saying that legislators shall be privileged from arrest in all cases except treason, felony, and breach of the peace starting from the 15 days ahead of the legislative session and running until lawmakers adjourn for the year. Watsek eventually was cited for criminal speeding. It is a misdemeanor to drive more than 20 miles over the limit in a business or residential district, as well as failure to provide proof of insurance. The case was dismissed in January after Watsek completed the defensive driving course and proved she had the legally required coverage. In the new lawsuit, Walinchek contends it's irrelevant even if Watsek was speeding, a point he does not concede. "She would have never been stopped," he wrote, presumably because a legislative identification placard attached to her license plate. And Walinchek said Watsek never believed she would be ticketed after the legislative session ended. And then, he said, police never provided any evidence she was speeding, whether in the form of a body camera footage or radar. All that goes to the heart of the claim that Watsek was singled out in being stopped and then charged with a misdemeanor after the session ended. It is believed that this was all part of a plan of members of the Tucson Police Department to act in concert with not-yet-known city officials to ruin plaintiff's good reputation because she was introducing legislation these members of TPD felt was adverse to their interest, Walinchek wrote. All that, he said, comes because she was investigating Tucson police, was an outspoken critic of city government, was a member of the Conservative Freedom Caucus, and because she is a woman and her primary opponent was a man who TPD officials felt could be better controlled than plaintiff. As to the city's problems with her, Walenchek said they were upset because she was pushing two bills. One would have scrapped voting centers where anyone can cast a vote, and instead of returned to when people could vote only at their local precincts. The other sought a constitutional amendment to wipe out the ability of cities like Tucson to have home rule through their own charters. Neither measure was approved, but all that her attorney charged was to harm Wacek and her legislative position by charging her with the bogus traffic crimes and publicizing it, knowing that by revealing it to the media outlets, adverse publicity would ensure and cause her to either drop out or lose her primary race she otherwise would have won, thus seriously harming her future occupation as a legislator and harming her career as a real estate agent. Then there was an incident in June after she was stopped, but before she was issued the citation, where Walenchek said his client was trying to help a constituent who said she had been harassed by Tucson police. Shortly thereafter, the Tucson PD endorsed Senator Wacek's opponent in the primary, the Republican primary, and sued to their efforts in besmirching plaintiff's reputation, he wrote. More likely, he meant the Arizona Fraternal Order of Police, as the department does not do endorsements. Wacek also took exception to a report filed by Lieutenant Lauren Petty, who said that the senator in a conversation with her claimed she was a victim of political persecution. Wacek said she did not say that, but that the comment put in the police report became part of news reports. Aside from claiming her civil rights were violated and that she is the victim of law enforcement's retaliatory conduct, Wacek also is complaining that the city has a policy of inaction in ensuring and being able to prove the scientific reliability of patrol car radar readouts, and such inactions amount to a failure to protect constitutional rights. Our next article is titled, Some Lawmakers Resist Raising Age for Tobacco Use. This article was written by Howard Fisher of Capital Media Services. Dateline, Phoenix. A half century ago, the rallying cry was old enough to fight, old enough to vote. Now some Republican Arizona lawmakers are making the same arguments about smoking in opposing efforts to raise the minimum age to buy or possess tobacco products in Arizona to 21 from 18. That would bring the state into conformity with a 2019 federal law. The lack of a state law, however, precludes the Attorney General's office, which has done enforcement and sting operations on retailers, from taking actions on those selling to customers who are 18, 19, or 20. SB 1247, which got preliminary approval this past week in the House, would change that. But not everyone is on board. Representative Nick Cupper said he has never smoked and sees absolutely zero benefit to cigarettes. However, I do acknowledge, obviously, that God has given us free will to make both good and bad decisions, said the surprised Republican. And the Constitution has enshrined that we have a responsibility to protect those rights. Cupper pointed out that the language in the measure is absolute. This bill, currently as written, would not allow members of the military who can die for their country to smoke, he said. Cupper said the only way he would change his mind is if an exception were created to those actively serving in the military or National Guard. Representative Alexander Kolodin said his objections to the legislation were more philosophical. And it starts, he said, with the argument by proponents that if the state doesn't bring its statutes into conformity with federal law, there would be a loss of federal dollars. That could be imminent. Richie Taylor of the Arizona Attorney General's office said that 2019 law has a 5-year grace period for the state to enact similar statutes that he said ended in December. And Representative Matt Gress, a Republican of Phoenix, who is sponsoring SB 1247, said that means an immediate loss of $5 million a year, with other federal dollars at risk. But Kolodin told colleagues they wouldn't make that part of their consideration. One thing that Kolodin said that one of the lessons from the COVID pandemic was that states each have the power to decide its own policies when it comes to public health. Well, if that's the case, we get to set our own stage for tobacco and vaping products, he said. And then there's that argument about being old enough to serve in the military. But Kolodin said that tells only part of the story. In fact, an 18-year-old is apparently in our society considered to be mature enough to decide who holds the nuclear launch codes, who governs the states, and thus matters of war and peace, and matters that affect the lives of every Arizonan, he said. And Culloden said that if those who are 18 are not considered to have enough ability to decide what to smoke, then perhaps the age of voting, lowered nationally with a constitutional amendment in 1971, should be raised back to 21. Gress, for his part, scoffed at the arguments foes of the bills were making, like whether being in the military should be an exception. "I don't know that I would want our fighting force to be smoking and messing up their lungs while they're defending America either," he said. Nor was Gress persuaded by the fact that 18-year-olds can vote, pointing out that it took an amendment to enshrine that right in the U.S. Constitution. "There is not a constitutional amendment that protects Americans' right to smoke cigarettes," he said. Gress acknowledged that there are inconsistencies like this in Arizona laws. But he said that doesn't mean that just because people can do some things at 18 doesn't mean they should be able to do all things. "I don't believe in lowering the drinking age to 18, Gress said. But Gress has shown he does believe that there should be some rights and privileges for those who are 18. Rights and privileges now reserved for those who are older. 2 years ago, shortly after being elected to the legislature, he crafted a measure to set the minimum age for legislators at 18. Individuals now have to be 25. In promoting the measure, Gress, who first ran for town council in Cyril, Oklahoma at 18, said he doesn't believe that his ideas at the time, like how to deal with money losing ambulance service, did not have merit because of his age. And he said that also must have been the belief of the 124 people who voted for him, though he lost. His proposal to lower the age for legislative qualification never even got a hearing. Gress told Capital Media Services he blames that on the political reality of trying to get such a measure through a legislature where everyone who would get to vote on it was at least 25, if not older. Incumbent members of safe districts are worried about young whippersnappers running against him, Gress said. And by safe, he means legislative districts where one party has such a voter registration edge that it's almost impossible for a candidate from another party to oust an incumbent. And it's on both sides of the aisle, Gress said. Still, that leaves a question. If Gress believes 18-year-olds are mature enough to make decisions about setting state policy and dividing up an $18 million budget, why does he want to deny them the right to make a decision about smoking, or for that matter, drinking? Gress concedes it comes down to his own personal beliefs. "I think running to serve the people is a good and healthy thing," he said. "I think pumping tar and chemicals in your body is a bad thing." The measure now needs a roll call vote in the House before going to the Senate, which has never voted on this version of the legislation. "None of this affects marijuana or similar products. The voter-approved laws make the use of that drug legal, include a requirement for people to be 21. Now we'll turn the page to the Tucson and Region section of the Arizona Daily Star for several important and informative articles. The first article is titled, "Bill Aims to Reduce Rate of Missing Indigenous." This article was written by Brandon Clark of Cronkite News, Dateline Phoenix. An Arizona bill to create a missing indigenous or endangered person alert system passed the House with unanimous support and is now in the final stages of review by the Senate before heading to the governor. HB 2281 explicitly focuses on missing Native persons or non-Native endangered individuals and claims to address the growing crisis of missing and murdered indigenous peoples in Arizona's 22 federally recognized tribal nations. It would facilitate an emergency advisory similar to Amber Alerts and Silver Alerts. For Anthony Sanchez Jr., head councilman of the Pueblo of Zuni Tribal Council, the notification system represents an important step in combating the high rates of missing and murdered tribal persons that have plagued North America for hundreds of years. Pueblo of Zuni tribal lands sit on the border of Arizona and New Mexico. "Now we're finally beginning being recognized as equals," Sanchez said. "It shows power of the community coming back together. They're out there not for themselves, but trying to get these individuals back home. Native communities have long faced obstacles to finding and protecting their populations. The lack of adequate resources, timely responses, and judicial challenges have left many families without support in finding their loved ones and feeling safe. Arizona ranks third in the country for the biggest number of indigenous missing persons cases, according to the 2022 data from the National Institute of Justice's National Missing and Unidentified Persons System. The Arizona bill, co-sponsored by Brian Garcia, Democrat of Tempe, and a member of the Pascua-Oyaki tribe, seeks to change that. The bill gets us that much closer to making sure that all of Arizona's communities are protected and safe. What we're asking with this bill is when someone goes missing, is endangered, we're able to send out that alert and hopefully save their life, Garcia said. Garcia pointed to the case of Emily Pike, a San Carlos Apache teen who went missing and whose mutilated remains were found near Globe last month. The state of Pike's remains have led police to suspect foul play. An Amber Alert was not sent out for her because there was no indication she had been abducted or was in danger, the primary requirement for activating an Amber Alert. Pike's death has resurfaced conversations about the missing and murdered indigenous people crisis across the country, and Native community members have been protesting and raising awareness for the cause in her name. The response from community members and the awareness around it highlights it in a very real and upsetting way. Indigenous peoples are just tired of having our own gone missing, becoming endangered and being murdered, Garcia said. Conditions would exist for notification qualifications similar to the Amber Alert and similar alert procedures. If triggered, authorities would be required to use all available local resources and determine that the person is in danger, either at risk to themselves or because they may be in the presence of a potentially dangerous person. Additionally, the individual must be over 18 and information that could assist in finding the person must be available. Tribal members under 18 are covered by the Amber Alert system. The bill also represents non-Native people in potentially dangerous situations if the individual meets the qualifications for the emergency alert. The Arizona Public of Safety, DPS, would oversee the notifications through the emergency alert system to ensure timely public distribution. DPS will also coordinate with similar systems in other states to expand the reach. Arizona's Missing and Murdered Indigenous Peoples Task Force played a part in the information of the NOTUS system. Governor Katie Hobbs formed the task force in March 2023. Senator Teresa Hetethly, Democrat of Tuba City, who is Navajo and chair of the task force, has seen research of other states' advisory systems weaving into Arizona's approach. Every law, especially in this sense, would have some conditions. We just need to see how it'll be implemented, Hetathly said. As an Arizona tribal member, Hetathly has watched her tribal nation evolve as its crisis grows. When we have a missing person, an indigenous missing person is not elevated. Many times these entities brush it aside. They think it's because of alcoholism or because of some addiction, Hetathly said. No matter what the situation is, loved ones report people missing, and that needs to be elevated. It needs to be investigated. According to 2023 FBI data, 10,650 missing American Indian and Alaskan Native people were reported in the United States. The Native Alert System concept was first introduced in Washington in 2022, paving the way for other states, including California, Colorado, and soon New Mexico, to implement similar measures. With 29 federally recognized tribal nations, Washington is one of the leading contributors to missing Native persons cases nationwide, per Name Us data. Chris Loftus, Director of Communications for the Washington State Patrol, said the state's system has sent 148 notifications since its launch and only 22 people remain missing. Notifications have led to locating people who have been kidnapped, run away, or killed. Native people, who make up 6% of Washington's population, are three times more likely to go missing. Even if the alert doesn't directly lead to resolution, it helps us get the broader story out that indigenous communities are uniquely vulnerable to crimes against a person. They're uniquely vulnerable to being victims of violent crimes and being victims of sexual crimes or sexual trafficking, Loftus said. He said these notifications serve as a tool for recovery and a deterrent. We have one case where the person who had taken someone heard the alert on the radio and had let their victim go because he knew that he was being looked for. It only has to happen once before it makes it all worthwhile, Lofta said. The main differences between Arizona's proposed system and Washington's are the qualifying conditions and broadcasting method. In Washington, any missing indigenous person automatically triggers a notification, while Arizona's system would have specific criteria. Because Washington's system has no restrictions, it isn't set as a loud emergency notification to cell phones like Amber or Silver alerts. Arizona would use a cell phone broadcasting system. Washington's advisories are shared through email subscriptions and social media, which lowers the visibility but doesn't potentially desensitize to the public with mass alerts, said Carrie Gordon, program manager and missing persons alert coordinator at the Washington State Patrol. Emergency broadcasts are only used if a recovery is imminent. Arizona's system also has an age requirement, making support more limited. Gordon explained how these differences affect the notification's impact. All we're doing is posting a poster to social media and sending it out to people who have subscribed to receive it. That is a very limited audience compared to an Amber Alert. But we're not able to use other tools that we would like to be able to use because there is no other criteria. Carolyn DeFord, anti-trafficking program manager of the domestic violence program for the Paliup tribe of Indians in Washington, knows how crucial the implementation of these systems can be for vulnerable communities. DeFord, whose mother went missing in 1999, understands the uncertainty that comes with a missing loved one. Her personal experiences, along with the tragic loss of her cousin to domestic violence, led to her advocacy. She now serves as a co-chair on the Washington State Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women and People Task Force, where she works with families to address the unique challenges they face. I didn't even realize it was advocacy. It was just empathy, DeFord said. Once that alert is issued, it's a reminder. It's reassurance that we're doing everything we can, that we're getting that message out to as many people as fast as possible. DeFord worries that frequent signals could lead to desensitization in Arizona. While she acknowledges that visibility is crucial in addressing the disparity, she fears the alerts might become another reason for the general public to tune out indigenous issues. Visibility is important, but I don't want to desensitize people, DeFord said. Our obligation is to ensure or do what we can to make sure that our people are not experiencing hurt and harm. The next article is titled, Doctor Gets Probation for Illegal Dog Surgery. This article was written by Erica Verst of the Arizona Daily Star. A Tucson doctor convicted of animal cruelty for performing a botched surgery on a dog has been sentenced to 6 months of probation. Dr. Raquel Marie Mercado Sepulveda, an obstetrician gynecologist, was sentenced in February for felony animal cruelty and a misdemeanor for practicing veterinary medicine without a license. Several other felonies were dropped. Animal advocates were displeased with the sentence. I think it's a pretty pathetic sentence for a case that this egregious, said Steve Kozacek, director of the Pima County Animal Care Center. Kozacek said his agency will conduct impromptu visits to assure she's doing her surgical work on people, not canines. Generally, Kozacek said probation follow-ups aren't always completed in these cases because of staffing issue, but he wants Mercado Sepulveda to know that's not going to be the case this time. In this case, this lady should count on us showing up unannounced because of the egregious nature of what was involved, he said. The criminal case started after a local vet raised concerns after treating a dog who had received a botched cesarean section, according to previous reports. Mercado Sepulveda was eventually arrested in January 2024. A search warrant reveals that 14 dogs and 3 rabbits were seized from her home. Our next item is titled UA Provost Finalist from Vermont. This article was written by Piranha Sanapanavar of the Arizona Daily Star. The fourth finalist in the University of Arizona Provost search is currently interim president at the University of Vermont, an appointment she's held since Suresh Garamella left the school for Tucson. Patricia A. Prelog has been serving as interim president at UVM since October 1st, when Garamella started his role at the UA's 23rd president. Prelog has been at UVM for 28 years. Prior to taking on the role of interim president, she served as provost and senior vice president at the school since 2019, the year Garamella took on the role there of university president. Prelog is set to visit the UA campus Monday, March 31st, for interviews and an open forum with faculty, students, and staff. The public forum will begin at 9 a.m. at the UA's John P. Schaefer Center for Creative Photography, 1030 North Olive Road. The first three finalists in the university's provost search, Eric Barker, Jenna Rickus, and William Bernard, have each had similar visits to the UA campus over the past 2 weeks. Among the topics they teach were asked about how they will handle DEIA, diversity, equality, equity, inclusion, and accessibility, matters in the current political climate, issues about law enforcement situations on campus, and enhancing student success. Since the Trump administration's federal orders on research funding and DEIA, the UA has deleted the words diversity and inclusion from its widely used Native Land Acknowledgement Statement and took down two of its DEIA-related websites in February. Both decisions, which have been protested by the UA community. Moreover, two of the three finalists who have already been to campus are from Purdue University, another institution where Garamella served as a professor and administrator before moving on to UVM. However, this isn't the first where a senior administrative position has been filled with a candidate Garamella had previously worked with at his former institutions. Tomas Diaz de la Rubio, the UA's senior vice president for research and innovation, worked at Purdue from 2015 to 2019 in various roles. Similarly, Richard Cate, UVM's vice president for finance and administration, was appointed by Garamella in January as the UA's new special advisor on finances and budgets. Prelog is a recognized expert in the nature and treatment of autism spectrum disorders, ASD, according to her UVM profile. She has a bachelor's degree in speech pathology and audiology and a master's degree in speech pathology from Kent State University. Her doctorate in speech-language pathology is from the University of Pittsburgh. Prelog has held numerous positions at UVM over the years. Those include professor of communication sciences and disorders, professor of pediatrics, chair of the Department of Communication Services, training director of a College of Medicine program, and most recently, dean of the nursing college. Prelog has also served as president of the American Speech-Language Hearing Association and is a National Academies of Practice Fellow in Speech-Language Pathology, Vermont Business Magazine reported. She has been described as an unwavering champion of student success, developing and promoting academic success goals to track progress across a wide variety of areas. She was awarded nearly $25 million in university, state, and federal funding as a primary investigator or co-primary investigator to develop innovations in interdisciplinary training supporting children and youth with neurodevelopmental disabilities and their families to facilitate training and teaching in speech-language pathology and to support her intervention work in ASD, according to the UVM website. Prelog has received numerous honors. Those include meritorious poster submission in the American Speech-Language Hearing Association in 2024, 2020, and 2016. The Jackie M. Gribbins Leadership Award from the Vermont Women in Higher Education in 2018. A visiting scholar recognition by the Prince Songkhla University at Hai Thai, Thailand in 2019. And a fellow of the National Academies of Practice in Speech-Language Pathology in 2018. Now we'll pause the broadcast reading for a reminder that you are listening to a broadcast reading of the Arizona Daily Star from Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Michael Shannon, and I'm a volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. If you miss any part of this program, you can access it on demand anytime on our website, www.sunsounds.org from the broadcast info and audio link. SunSounds is also available on your smart home device. Now it's time to flip the pages to the Nation and World section of the Arizona Daily Star to check out several important news articles there. The first article is titled Japan Indispensable. This article was written by Mary Yamaguchi of the Associated Press, Dateline Tokyo. U.S. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth called Japan on Sunday an indispensable partner in deterring growing Chinese assertiveness in the region and announced upgrading the U.S. military command in Japan to a new warfighting headquarters. Hegseth, who is on his first Asia trip with Japan as his second stop, also stressed the need for both countries to do more to accelerate the strengthening of their military capability as the region faces China's assertive military actions and a possible Taiwan emergency. Japan is our indispensable partner in deterring communist Chinese military aggression, Hegseth said at the beginning of his talks with Japan's Defense Minister General Nakatani in Tokyo. The U.S. is moving fast, as you know, to reestablish deterrence in this region and around the world. His comments came as an assurance at a time when Japan has been worried about how U.S. engagement in the region may change under President Donald Trump's America First policy, Japanese defense officials said, speaking on condition of anonymity, citing protocol. Trump has also threatened to impose trade tariffs on Japan, a key U.S. ally, sparking more concern. The two sides agreed to accelerate plans to jointly develop and produce missiles, such as advanced medium-range air-to-air missiles, or MRAM, and consider producing SM-6 surface-to-air missiles to help ease shortage of munitions, Nakatani said. The ministers also agreed to speed up the process involving the maintenance of U.S. warships and warplanes in Japan to strengthen and complement Japanese and U.S. defense industries. Japan and the U.S. decided in July to upgrade the command and control of the Japanese military as well as U.S. forces at the East Asian country under the Biden administration, a major structural change aimed at bolstering joint operational and response capabilities. Japan is home to more than 50,000 U.S. troops. Tokyo last week launched the Japan Joint Operations Command, or JJOC, whose mission is to coordinate Japanese ground, maritime, and air defense forces in a significant action to further strengthen the capabilities to respond to contingencies and better cooperate with the U.S. Hegseth announced Sunday the upgrading of its current command, U.S. Forces Japan, by placing a unified operational command to function as a joint force headquarters to liaise with its Japanese counterpart to serve as warfighting headquarters to bolster speed and capability of their troops' joint operations. The Pentagon chief said the reorganization of U.S. troops is a step to better prepare for a possible conflict. America and Japan both work for peace, but we must be prepared, he said. The Japanese defense officials say they are not expecting a significant change in their responsibility or an increase in U.S. troops in Japan. The next article from the Nation of the World section of the Arizona Daily Star is titled Ramadan Ends, Eid of Sadness. This article was written by Wafa Sharafa, Mohammed Yayou, and Tia Goldenberg of the Associated Press, Dateline Deir al-Balah, Gaza Strip. Palestinians in the Gaza Strip had little to celebrate Sunday as they marked the normally festive Eid al-Fitr with rapidly dwindling food supplies and renewed fighting in the Israel-Hamas war. Israeli strikes killed at least 19 people, mostly women and children, health officials said. Many prayed outside the demolished mosques on the holiday marking the end of the Muslim fasting month of Ramadan. It's supposed to be a joyous occasion when families feast and purchase new clothes for children, but most of Gaza's 2 million people are just trying to survive. It's the Eid of Sadness, Adel El-Shair said, after attending prayers amid rubble in the central town of Deir el-Balah. We lost our loved ones, our children, our lives, and our futures. 20 members of this extended family have been killed by Israeli strikes, including 4 young nephews in a few days ago, he said, and began to cry. Israel ended the ceasefire with Hamas and resumed the 17-month war earlier this month with a surprise bombardment that killed hundreds after the militant refused to accept changes to the truce reached in January. Israel has not allowed food, fuel, or humanitarian aid to enter Gaza for a month. "There is killing, displacement, hunger, and a siege," said Said Al-Kord, a worshipper. "We go out to perform God's rituals in order to make children happy, but as for the joy of Eid, there is no Eid. Arab mediators are trying to get the truce back on track." Hamas said Saturday it had accepted a new proposal from Egypt and Qatar. Israel said it made a counterproposal in coordination with the United States, which has also been mediating. The details were not immediately known. Meanwhile, the Palestinian Red Crescent Society said the bodies of 8 of its emergency medical technicians and 5 members of Gaza Civil Defense were recovered a week after they and their ambulances vanished in Rafah during heavy fire. The PRC has said a 9th colleague was still missing, adding that the targeting of medics cannot be seen as anything other than a war crime. Gaza's health ministry asserted that some of the bodies had been bound and shot in the chest and called on the United Nations and other international organizations to investigate and hold Israel accountable. Israel's military on Sunday said its troop opened fire on vehicles advancing suspiciously. It asserted that 9 terrorists were killed. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said Israel would continue military operations while negotiating. He rejected claims that Israel does not want to end the war while laying out conditions that go beyond the signed ceasefire agreement. "Hamas will disarm. Its leaders will be allowed out. We will look out for the general security in the Gaza Strip and allow for the realization of President Donald Trump's plan," Netanyahu told a cabinet meeting. Trump has proposed that Gaza's population be resettled in other countries so the U.S. can redevelop Gaza for others. The next article is titled, "Minneapolis Officials Want Answers About ICE Detention." This article is written by the Associated Press, Dateline Minneapolis. Officials in Minnesota are seeking answers in the case of a University of Minnesota graduate student who is being detained by U.S. immigration authorities for unknown reasons. University leadership said Immigration and Customs Enforcement detained the student Thursday at an off-campus residence. Officials said the school was not given advance notice about the detention and did not share information with federal authorities. The student's name and nationality have not been released. State and local leaders called on federal authorities to explain their actions. "My office and I are doing all we can to get information about this concerning case," Minnesota Senator Amy Klobuchar said in a post on the social media site X. "We're in contact with the university and understand they had no prior warning or information that led us to this detainment." She said that international students are a major part of the fabric of life in the school and our community. This detained student is enrolled in business school at the university's Twin Cities campus. University officials said the school is providing the student with support services. The university's graduate labor union organized a protest Saturday outside the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Service office in downtown Minneapolis. Organizers said they stood in solidarity with international students facing uncertain futures as the new Trump administration pursues an immigration crackdown. Now we'll check out the Arizona Daily Star business section for useful articles in there. Article title is "Peace of Mind in Your Pocket." Low balance, large purchase, usual activity. If you don't already get bank account alerts such as these, it might be a good time to set them up to help monitor your finances. Most consumers already use a mobile banking app. 81% use it at least monthly, according to the American Bankers Association. Mobile bank alerts, which help customers stay aware of their finances and watch for suspicious activity, are one of the advantages unique to online banking. Today's mobile banking alerts provide an array of options to help consumers keep their bank accounts in good standing, avoid unnecessary fees, and protect themselves from fraud, says Paul McAdams, Senior Director of Regional Banking at J.D. Power. These 8 alerts serve several purposes and can help you bank better. Number 1, low balance alert. Load balance alerts let you know when your bank account balance drops to a predetermined amount, which could be $20, $500, or another selected amount. Depending on the bank, these alerts can come in the form of an email, text message, or push notification, or all three. A load balance alert could be helpful for consumers nervous about racking up overdraft fees or those who want to keep tabs on how much money is in their accounts without having to sign into an app or website. Number 2. Direct deposit alert. Direct deposit alerts can let you know when your paycheck hits your checking account, which can help in scheduling bill payments and budgeting. If you use automatic bill pay services, direct deposit alerts let you know when your funds are available for automatic withdrawals. Alert number 3. Unusual account activity alert. Another alert to consider setting up is one that notifies you when there is an unusual change in your account status. Large standalone transactions are a red flag for fraudulent activity, and unusual account activity alerts will immediately make you aware of it. The sooner you report fraudulent activity, the greater your chances of getting reimbursed due to a stolen debit card or an account number ending up in the wrong hands. Consumers who use mobile banking alerts are slightly more likely to detect and contact their bank regarding fraud or unauthorized account activity, providing a greater sense of protection, McAdams said. Alert number 4. Large purchase alert. Depending on the bank, there may be an option to set alerts for when a large amount of money is spent at one time. Mobile app users may be able to specify a threshold for what they consider a concerningly large purchase. The alert can help ensure the purchase doesn't go unnoticed and speed up the process of investigation and reimbursement. Alert number 5. Large ATM withdrawal alert. Consider opting for an alert when a big cash withdrawal takes place. That way you'll know instantly if your money is taken from your account by someone else. Additionally, some banking alerts may send alerts specifically when an account has exceeded the daily withdrawal limits. Alert number 6. Debit card alert. Debit card alerts also can be helpful for tracking purchases. The bank may be able to send notifications when the purchase is made with one or more of your debit cards. Alternatively, a debit card alert can be used to notify you when a transaction is declined or made in an uncustomary location, such as another country. Alert number 7. Profile change alert. When it comes to digital banking, there is a risk that personal data may be threatened by data breaches or scams. One easy way to stay on top of potential threats to your accounts is to opt for a profile change alert, which notifies you of any updated personal detail. Alert number 8. Setting an upcoming payment alert could be useful for any scheduled or recurring payment, such as bills, loan payments, or subscriptions. Not only will this alert make you aware of money that's about to be withdrawn from your account, it can also keep you in the loop for any recurring payments and subscriptions that you might have forgotten to cancel, or that you never signed up for in the first place. Now we'll head over to the opinion section of the Arizona Daily Star for several interesting statements of opinions. The first one is titled, Serving Your Country. This opinion was written and submitted to the Arizona Daily Star by Chris Talgo, who is the editorial director at the Heartland Institute in suburban Chicago. As a libertarian and conservative, I understand that compulsory national service could seem like an infringement on personal freedom, but I still think it's worth exploring under specific guidelines. When most people hear the term national service, they automatically think of the military. Many nations, including Israel and Switzerland, require at least some military service. This is not the case in the United States, which has an all-volunteer military. In the United States, less than 1% of the population are active duty service members. Though it would be beneficial to encourage more Americans to enlist in the army in the military, it shouldn't be mandatory. Yet imposing some national service requirements would pay big dividends, given how divided our country has become in recent years. Several studies show that national service increases civic engagement, helps develop critical life skills, and has a positive impact on young adults' health, safety, and well-being. The idea of compulsory national service also is popular among the American people. This includes young Americans who would be most affected by a national service requirement. 3/4 of 18 to 24-year-olds support an 18-month national service commitment, according to a survey. An obligatory tenure in national service for all U.S. citizens on graduating from high school would serve many purposes. This includes fostering a renewed sense of national unity and pride. Opponents of compulsory service argue it would violate some of the nation's most cherished principles. They maintain it would directly encroach on Americans' personal freedom. This is misguided, considering all citizens must uphold several duties. This includes serving on juries, and men can be drafted during a time of war. As citizens of a nation, we should feel obligated to participate in activities that build a sense of national identity and purpose. Moreover, we should be willing to sacrifice at least a little for the good of the country. Unfortunately, sacrificing anything, even for a few months, for the sake of the country is a tall task. It wasn't always this way. In 1961, during his inaugural address, President John F. Kennedy said, "Ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country." Those words still resonate. Of course, citizens could do many things for the country if a stint in national service became mandatory. Imagine a program that enlists young Americans to pick up trash and litter in their local communities. Or how about a program that recruits young people to help provide care at housing centers for old adults? The possibilities are almost endless. Today, when Americans complete their high school studies, they are expected to join the workforce or continue their education. As a former high school teacher, I know what many 18-year-olds are not ready for this next step of their life. As such, a brief period in which these young Americans would be required to choose a national service program would help them mature. It also would aid them as they contemplate what they would like to pursue as they reach adulthood. The next opinion letter to the Arizona Daily Star is titled, "Trump is Worst Salesman for Giving Back to Nation." This article was submitted by James Rosen. Mr. Rosen is a former political reporter and Pentagon correspondent for McClatchy Newspapers. Now is the worst time to implement required national service for young people. In a nation that has turned individual freedom to a fetish, such an idea would always be a hard sell. Now, with an autocratic president and a sidekick car salesman slashing federal jobs, it would be a disaster. Forced service would further sap strained military recruiting, which has struggled to meet targets since the draft ended as half a century ago. Forced service would add cost to a federal budget that President Donald Trump and billionaire White House advisor Elon Musk claim, with typical exaggeration, is bloated. One advocate, New York City lawyer and Navy vet Steve Cohen, puts the annual cost at $133 billion, a price tag he acknowledges is a lot of money. Forced service would further demoralize young people already hurt by high housing prices, stubborn inflation, and a persistent hangover from pandemic, including lost schooling and painful isolation. Worse still, a mandatory national service program would normalize the scattershot reforms Musk and his uninformed hatchet toadies are overseeing. It's easy to imagine Musk replacing capable civil servants receiving solid pay and good benefits with low-paid temporary newbies and then boast about the short-term savings while ignoring the long-term costs. Musk is a son of South African apartheid who shrugs at his ludicrous mistakes, such as ending Ebola prevention and cutting cancer research. He would be delighted to see young people doing the jobs not performed by inmates in orange prison suits. Picking up litter on highways and pulling weeds in forests, now there's a future for young people searching for hope. To have even a ghost of a chance, a national call for service, whether voluntary or forced, requires a leader who inspires in both word and deed. It requires a President Franklin Roosevelt suffering in silence from polio and using fireside radio chants to chart an escape from the Great Depression. Roosevelt was a visionary who gave desperate men and women real jobs at the Civilian Conservation Corps. It requires President John Kennedy to urge Americans to ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country. It was a dynamic idealist dispatching young people around the globe in Peace Corps crews to demonstrate an alternative to war. It requires a President Lyndon Johnson to start a VISTA program to combat poverty at home, or a war hero such as President George W.H. Bush to promote 1,000 points of lights, or President Bill Clinton to urge his anti-Corps members to teach in underfunded schools. Instead, we have Trump. Even before sitting in the Oval Office, he told twisted tales of American carnage and painted dark, fantastical portraits of foreign rapists pouring into our country. This is a man who scorned the losers and suckers buried at Francis Ursay Martin Cemetery as he toured the gravesites of fallen World War I soldiers. This is a man who declined to praise as hero John McCain, the late Senator Admiral's son, who endured years of torture as a prisoner during the Vietnam War. Trump is a man who procured a suspect diagnosis of bone spurs fake news to avoid serving in the same war. Trump put self-aggrandizement above the most basic notion of patriotism. He is a president who in his first term profiled from visiting dignitaries staying at his Washington hotel. Trump routinely breaks promises from Mexico paying for the wall at the southern border to ending inflation on day one for his second term and putting a fair end to the Ukraine war. Imagine that man trying to inspire young people with an exhausted or exalted notion of public service. Trump fancies himself as a great salesman, but his effort to pitch a new national program would only fail. Young people would see through the Trumpian ruse. There would be no art in that kind of deal, only trickery and betrayal. Due to time constraints, we have reached the end of today's reading of the Arizona Daily Star, the Monday, March 31st, 2025 edition. For Sun Sounds of Arizona, this is Michael Shannon, your volunteer reader. Thank you very much for listening.